And now, Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hi, I am Dean Haglund here in the offices of the Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here, as always, with your co-host and mine, Mr. Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Dean Haglund. Thank you, Garrett Watley,
for that fantastic, funky opening.
And thank you, Dean Haglund, for that fantastic, funky opening.
He enhanced it quite a bit.
You, of course, composed that temporary new
That's our temporary
title
track.
Song. Of course, as loyal listeners of Chilpack Hollywood Hour know, we are funky. We have for quite some time known that we needed a new theme song because our public domain
free wave
file that we had downloaded from a library that we had purchased was becoming far too ubiquitous.
Absolutely. We heard it in
commercials,
a muffler commercial.
And, of course, on a viral YouTube video where a motorcycle took out a wild turkey. And if that's not a description of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, I don't know what is.
A motorcycle taking out a wild turkey. It's true.
So we've wanted one, and we haven't quite found one that worked.
No.
We're not saying that the one that you... I'm certainly not saying you composed works. But with Garrett Watley's vocal enhancements, it certainly sets, I think, the right tone.
A hilarity tone.
And so therefore, you know, on a temporary basis, it, I think, functions well. And let's face it, we always intended the other one to be a temporary theme. And
for know, 4 years, it was
for
very temporary.
For more than 4 years, we're almost to 5 years, it indeed served well as a temporary theme. Somewhere around year 10, we are bound to get the permanent theme song.
We cannot wait.
Of your Chilpack Hollywood
It's
hour.
Great to have long-range plans when you have a production meeting. To talk it out, you know, 5-10 years out.
The last two shows that we've done have been quite out of the ordinary. I mean, last week's show was our New Year's resolution show, and that indeed is a tradition.
Yes.
But it's out of the ordinary in terms of what we do the other 51 weeks of the year.
Right.
Though our last show of the year was also quite lovely.
Yes.
And a rather unusual show where we didn't discuss... many of the topics and didn't have many of the segments that people have come to expect. And certainly we did not have any production meetings really on air during those two weeks.
No, where we should have actually, because now we're in January with a temporary soundtrack.
Though indeed we are back.
Yes.
This is the second show of 2012.
Very exciting.
And we are... Of course, with all these changes that you're hearing, the new bells and whistles, courtesy of composers like Dean Haglund and voice artists such as Garrett Watley.
Yep.
We also have other surprises in this show, some new things. Courtesy, in part, of our good friend, loyal listener, Anthony Kilna.
Ooh.
Kilna submitted some music.
Really?
And we're putting it to use in a very, very good way. And I think we'll, in fact... kick it off right now.
Let's have a listen.
The Chilpack Hollywood lawsuit of the week.
Wow.
Indeed, we're back at it, and we're going to start with the Chilpack Hollywood lawsuit of the
week. Lawsuit of the week.
And the first lawsuit of 2012 is actually one we discussed on a few occasions
right.
in 2011.
This is the ageism case of IMDb.
How did you know?
Well, I was following it, and I just saw the latest judgment to come down, where the young actress, who's been anonymous up till now, if she wants...
I like that you referred to her as a young actress.
Right.
God bless you, because this is the whole thing.
The whole thing.
This is an actress of at least 40 years of age.
Yep.
Who has remained anonymous to this point and has sued IMDb for their practice of revealing ages, even though performers have not given consent.
Absolutely.
And because such an act does lead to making them less hireable, according to the complaint. A feeling that has been echoed by every guild and union that has supported her lawsuit.
Yeah.
Because you were one of the first people to point out about ageism in the writing ranks, and I had never even heard about this.
That young girl who had to eat cheese to pretend she was 18 years old to write on some youthful teenage shows.
But exactly, fantastic writers who can't get jobs on shows because once it's found that they have credits going back a few decades,
right?
As if that, you would think that might be a plus, but no, because they don't know how to speak to those young people who don't give a rat's ass about television anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, in a very strongly worded decision this week, a judge added a new wrinkle to the case, which was...
She has to tell her age if she wants to get the settlement.
No, she doesn't have to tell her age. She has to tell her name.
Oh, tell her name. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Her age is already out of the...
It's already out there. She has to add the name to the age.
Right.
Basically, completely... de-anonymizing herself. Is that a word?
De-anonymizing. That's the name, actually, of what your new theme song is going to be when we sell that to a library. De-anonymize.
That's my total rap name. I'm de-anonymized.
That's brilliant, because, by the way, the first four letters of de-anonymize are Dean.
Oh, my gosh.
Who knew? True. That's and this amazing. Has been another installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood.
See how that works?
Yes. She has to. This is...
Odd.
Is it odd? I mean, I don't know. How can you have a lawsuit where the person who's filing the suit remains anonymous? I mean...
They do trust funds all the time. I mean, yes, you hide one's identity in terms of crimes so that you are not victimized by society at large.
Those are not civil cases.
No, those are often assault and battery or where you're in the witness protection program, perhaps. Those names are never revealed.
Right, but again, these are not the people laying a civil suit onto someone else.
Right.
I don't know under what... under what grounds? I mean, apparently the judge came down quite strongly that, of course, this woman has to reveal her. Because, so I guess somehow precedent, upon which all these judgments are always issued, precedent must say that someone has to. I wonder about this idea of, you know, being able to be confronted by the identity of your accuser, that you have a right to this,
to be a dinner,
whether that comes into play.
I guess. But you know what? I watch People's Court, and I watch Judge Judy, and there's many a person on there who just does not use their name or doesn't use their last name.
But those shows are not actually real.
Those cases are real. Don't you hear the announcer off the top? These cases are real. The judgments are real. And then
right, and they're actors playing many of these.
They are not.
We both know people who have been on these.
Yes,
and
when they're slow weeks. And I also know somebody who was a producer who had to go and comb civil court to get people to sign on to come on to People's Court. So there was a reality to it. Anyway, the point is...
The point is for me that this sets up a very interesting choice then for this woman, right? In terms of pursuing this, she gets to she has to basically out her age in order to prevent IMDb from outing people's ages.
Right. So she has to take the bullet, but she's claiming $1 million in damages. So I thought he was saying that you won't get $1 million unless you tell us your name. So you can win and IMDb can change their thing. But if you want the money that's attached to that, then you have to say your name.
No.
No?
No. Okay. She has sued under the name Jane Doe. She has 14 days to refile the case. The case has not been heard.
Oh.
She has 14 days to refile the case under her own legal name, or it will be dismissed.
Oh.
The woman now must choose to either move forward under her real name or drop the litigation entirely.
Right.
You are right that there could be damages if she could do this, but I think it still comes down to this idea of exactly taking the bullet.
Right.
She's going to out her age because we already know the age. Now we'll know who the actress is.
Right.
And
they've already
put those two together.
And on the website, they published her picture and her name already. Yeah. And if you look at
Well, IMDb has already done that. But now publicly, she will have to out herself. And it does become this issue for me, I think, of do you embrace the harm that you're charging them with committing in order that other people don't have to have that happen? Now, it is possible, you're right, that she could win damages that then offset that. Of course, there's the other thing where if she takes such a heroic stance, certainly a TV movie is going to be in the works, I would imagine.
I would think so. And she could play herself.
If she weren't too old to do so.
We need you only younger. Oh, that's horrible.
Wow.
That is horrible.
What a great way to start the new year with your Chill Pack Hollywood.
There's one other issue of the week. As someone who's gone through a lawsuit with an agency, who shall remain nameless, is that you're also branded as a bit of a troublemaker. After that, even if that lawsuit was kept super top secret, still the chatter is amongst the actors and the producers and the casting agents is that, there was some trouble between you and your agent that went to a legal situation. You are now branded as...
True, but taking on IMDb, which is owned by Amazon, so taking on Amazon, I don't know if that causes you trouble... Certainly not within the ranks of what you're describing, producers, writers, directors, casting directors. Now, in terms of corporate parents that own studios and own networks who are beholden to
Amazon
companies like Amazon, maybe, but I also think you're just such a small fly in the ointment.
Yeah, I guess so.
That... Yeah, I don't know.
And this happened in Vancouver, so that was a smaller town, too.
And I haven't even paid enough attention to whether or not, I mean, did she have a good career for herself?
She had a few credits, but but like anything, it was imperative that she stayed young. I know many, here's a story. There was a model, a husband and wife, and she was a model, and she actually... he shopped for her in the junior section so that she would always wear younger looking clothes so that she could continue to model as like a teenage to 20-year-old kind of thing. And
this sounds dangerously like the trouble that Oscar nominated director David O. Russell found himself getting into this week when he groped his own 19-year-old niece.
Oh, I missed that.
But
story.
It was totally consensual, apparently, according to him. And as the writers were quick to point out, she's not a blood relative. Because you have a 50-50 chance that your niece or your nephew is going to be a blood relative, right? You know, it's...
So if it's not,
then
please, uncle.
Game's on.
Yeah, it's totally consensual.
And she's 19. She's not...
Underage.
She's not underage. Right. So see, he hasn't... Apparently, the idea being that if it doesn't violate any laws of incest or the
morality?
Statutory
rape. Yeah.
If it doesn't violate those laws, it's okay.
I see.
Right?
Thank you. Thanks for laying that out.
Anyway, so that kind of seems like we're entering into that.
Yeah, really. Unbelievable.
Anyway, your friend who did the... was it your friend who did this shopping for his?
Yeah.
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 Who was that? Out that person.
I'm not going to.
All right.
I haven't seen him in years.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Wingnut of the Week.
Ah.
Indeed. One of our favorite recurring segments on this show through the second half of 2011 or the last part of 2011 became indeed Chill Pack Hollywood Wingnut of the Week.
My favorite.
So named by our dear friend Mark Bennett.
Yes.
After he heard a particularly scathing review of The Truth Is Out There
by
a viewer on Twitter.
Yes.
Who said that far from revealing the truth is out there, buried the truth by giving voice to so many wingnuts. So we decided we want to celebrate the wingnuts.
Yes.
Wherever they may be. Many of these that we've focused on have been historic figures.
Right. From the past.
Who were crazy. They were committed.
Vanguards.
They were marginalized by their societies because of their crazy views, which, by the way, turned out to be right.
Right. Exactly.
And
later on, generations. generations.
I have also focused my attention on looking around at some of the people that we are inclined to refer to as wingnuts now.
Right, in our presence.
To see, though, how we might be able to celebrate them, even as you and I perhaps might find their stance
a bit
crazy.
A little odd.
Right?
Yes.
But there must be some way that, the expression of these views or these behaviors serve.
Right.
So how can we celebrate them? And I thought today, indeed, we would put the Hollywood in Chilpack Hollywood wingnut of the week.
There's a wingnut in Hollywood?
And it would be hard to imagine.
I can't imagine.
Not at this table?
What?
Co-honorees this week.
Really?
Donald Kushner and Ely Samaha. Who are the, among other things, I mean, they both have been producers and they've been entrepreneurs in show business.
Sure.
But they are the new owners of Grauman's Chinese Theater in
right.
Hollywood.
Yes.
And in their year of stewardship
so far
of the legendary landmark,
right.
The Grauman Chinese Theater.
Built in 1924, I'm going to say?
No, 22? I think later than that, 27.
Oh, 27, yeah, when sound first came. So they were talkie pictures.
And of course, seen in so many movies. I mean, it's one of those icons that still to this day, whenever anything cuts to action in Los Angeles, one of the first things you show is the Chinese Theater.
Absolutely. It's where the footprints and the handprints and the cements.
And this brings up the wingnut behavior of the week. Prior to this year, the most hand and footprint ceremonies that there had ever been in a single year was 9 in 1927, the first year.
Wow. That's
in existence when people like Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks
right.
were Chaplin were putting their putting their hands and feet being immortalized in cement in the forecourt of the Chinese Theater.
And 9 in 1 year.
Who doesn't love the I Love Lucy episode where she tries to steal one of the the pieces of concrete?
Okay. Hilarious.
This year they've broke the record because of course
2011 you mean.
Yeah, in 2011 there were, I mean, we live in the new golden era, certainly. And certainly box office bears this out.
Yes.
Iconic figures.
That
so,
draw
by
the
all
people.
Means, they should all be remembered for eternity in cement outside. Such iconic figures as the Chipmunks were among the 11 different hand and footprint ceremonies this year.
Are you sure a chipmunk just didn't run across wet cement? And they just put the chipmunks in
there? Robert Duvall, that's kind of cool.
Okay, I'll give you that one.
Jennifer Aniston.
She sold her house, so maybe she did it as a way to say, hey, I'm leaving town.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
It wasn't a foot. She just actually, there was wet cement, and she waved goodbye.
That's right.
Mickey Rourke? Now, I know Mickey Rourke has had a great comeback.
Yeah.
He's an actor we've loved.
Love.
He's an actor we've tolerated. He's an actor we've asked whatever happened to.
Yes.
He's immortalized in for what film? Now, remember, for these ceremonies, and by the way, this is what gets at this. These are very expensive ceremonies that are paid for.
By the studio.
By the studios as publicity.
Right. So you go see the movie that they're in.
So what was the Mickey Rourke one for
this
year?
Harley Davidson and Marlboro Man's coming out on DVD.
Finally. The anniversary issue. You had the cast of the Twilight movies.
Dear God.
Yeah.
Okay. Silence.
Yeah. I actually looked up some of the legendary performers who were not there, and blissfully I've forgotten who they are right now because I just looked at it and I said, so these, you know, people, you know, I don't even want to guess who they were, but I mean, these were Oscar winners. These were icons who don't have their hands and footprint in cement.
Yeah.
But Taylor Lautner does. I mean, that was brilliant. That was brilliant. But even is not where I want to get to with this.
There's more.
How about French DJ David Guetta?
I'm not listening to my French DJ.
How about the Smurfs?
They were right beside the Chipmunks.
How about Kobe Bryant? Immortalized in... No, Kobe Bryant hasn't been in a film.
Right. So he's a But to point out, in the corner of
celebrate this
Hollywood and Vine, the astronauts who landed on the moon have a star.
But that's a star, and that was an iconic. Their star is for television achievement.
Oh,
and
true.
That was they an were iconic a... television moment.
Right. So Kobe Bryant's been on TV,
but that's not a star. He has a hand and footprint ceremony in the forecourt of the Chinese theater. Now they defend themselves by saying not all of these will stay here, and some of the ones that are here need to be repaired. So they're going to go to the shop where they repair these, or some are going to go to the Chinese Six upstairs. The kids' stuff, they said, will go up in front of the Chinese Six. Whatever. What I'm trying to do is not criticize this behavior.
No.
But how do we celebrate this? How is this wingnut behavior actually genius at work?
Well, I also know one other thing that you haven't mentioned. Is there, because they've licensed that image, they're building replicas of it in Abu Dhabi and various, I think, six other cities around the world. So there'll be replicas of the Chinese man. So it's important that they mass manufacture handprints in cement so that they can be exported to other countries.
In front of course, the replicas. When I first read this and I talked about, you know, the icons that are not there versus Taylor Lautner, I was, of course, a little bit aghast.
A bit.
Right?
Yes.
At the same time, though, all these people who say, oh, come on, you can't deny this. You can't do this. It's an icon. You can't tear at the fabric of, you know, this legend of this, you know, it was always a marketing thing.
It was always a marketing thing
to try to make this an important theater. This is a theater that is only important at this point because of its history, because nobody goes there anymore.
True.
Nobody goes to theaters anyway. Anything that gets theaters publicity coverage, that makes the idea of going to the movies fun, that promotes movies, any of this, we might need.
Exactly.
And, oh, by the way, these kids who are excited because there's the Smurfs, there's the Chipmunks, there's the cast of the original Star Trek. There's whatever the thing is that lures you to it.
Yes.
You might take the time to read these because it is fun to go through and read these things.
And see that history.
And to see the history. And also just to read. You might read things by people you don't know.
Right.
But many of these people wrote little messages.
True.
One of my favorites, Humphrey Bogart, wrote, "Dear Sid," to Sid Grauman.
Right. He knew him personally.
The original entrepreneur behind the Grauman Chinese Theater. "Dear Sid, may you never die until I kill you." Humphrey Bogart.
Lovely.
You may become intrigued by who this Humphrey Bogart character
right.
is.
Right. Fantastic.
And I know many people, Pliskin is rolling his eyes right now because the way I have defended in the past, needless remakes, pointless, awful remakes. But the point is, nothing is happening to these originals.
True.
These people are still staying there. They're not going to get rid of John Wayne. They're not going to get rid of,
No, I think importantly that if they're making all these replicas around the world, that they're going to need cement hands in front of them.
And if the idea is to have icons,
why not distribute that worldwide?
Well, and but more in terms of who is being put their hand and footprints.
All right.
You can't judge the icons that are going in there by the icons of
the previous acclaim. Absolutely. Here you are mocking the Smurfs and the Chipmunks, and yet, 1977, who put their hands in the cement? R2-D2 and C-3PO.
How am I mocking? I'm the one who's celebrating.
You are celebrating.
And a tip of the hat, which always, of course, as our friend Stephen Colbert has inspired, it always involves a little bit of the wag of the finger, because we don't like to deal strictly in the positive.
Right.
Anyway, those are our co-honorees, Donald Kushner, Ely Samaha, the Chilpak Hollywood Hour Wingnuts of the Week.
Get people into the theater. Good on you, I say. Well done.
Last week, we did do our New Year's resolution show, Dean Hagelin.
And already I have... Oh, no, I'm on track.
We had our collective resolution that we talked about.
Right.
Again... what we're reading.
Yes.
Dean Hagelin, what are you reading?
I'm reading Titian by David Hudson. A fantastic...
About the painter.
The painter, yeah.
I remember...
Tiziano Vecchiello.
I remember something very unique about colors.
Yes. Titian... you're thinking Tiepolo. T Tiepolo developed.
I've never heard of Tiepolo. I'm thinking of Titian.
Titian? Yes. His colors were spectacular. Right now, it is a journey of the author finding he's in Venice, and he writes about his own journey trying to find the house. And when he died, apparently his house was looted of all its artwork. And he's going around Europe finding the artwork. It's an investigative nonfiction novel that also tells the history of Titian. It's fantastic.
That's great. So yes. It is fiction or it's nonfiction?
It's nonfiction. But
it still reads kind of like a detective.
Like a detective. So, cause
true crime.
True crime, because it's following him and he's talking to various guides and people who live in Venice and stuff.
This is kind of a kindred spirit to the novel that I just finished, because as you know, my personal resolution was not about the number of books or whatever, but to make sure I read 25 pages a day.
Right.
Especially ending the day that way by turning off the laptop, turning off the editing, the Kindle, whatever it is, give my eyes a break from the backlit screens. And
get a little paper in front of that.
And then read. So I was able to already finish first novel of the year.
Holy crap.
A wonderful gothic piece called The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón.
Of course.
It's truly a gothic novel, and you know, I mean, ghosts and curses and long since dead mysteries and people coming back from the dead, and it's set
sounds like Twilight
before, during, after Spanish Civil War, World War II, and all within the streets of Barcelona, and focusing on the world of book selling, and a young boy discovers a thought to be impossible, unavailable copy of a book, The Shadow of the Wind.
I see.
Because this author, Julian Carax, has had all of his copies destroyed. Every work of his lifetime, none of which were successful anyway, for some reason have been systematically destroyed. And the people who have refused to give up their copies have been found dead, and the books have been destroyed.
Wow.
So this boy finds one and falls in love with the book without knowing anything about this curse, about this history behind it, and decides he wants to learn everything he can about the author. So a little boy sets off and
on an adventure,
and starts, you know, a 400-page detective mystery. It's fun on all those levels, very romantic and sweeping and historic and, you know, a good ghost story. There were times when I actually got a little scared at times.
Had to turn on the lights.
But it also is just, obviously a love letter to books, but more than a love letter to books, a love letter to readers of books. And I share with you just two lines that I think explain why we have what we're reading.
I see.
Hopefully each week.
Right.
On your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. B says that the art of reading is slowly dying, that it's an intimate ritual, that a book is a mirror that offers us only what we already carry inside us, that when we read, we do it with all our heart and mind, and that great readers are becoming more scarce by the day.
Wow. You know, that reminds me of a thing I heard in Seattle, where they've started a reading club. Not a book club. You don't discuss the book you're reading. You just come into this lounge area with a fireplace, and there's these chairs and couches, and you just read, and you don't talk to anybody, and you shut up, and you read a book, and you all just sit communally in this room reading. And then after 2 or 3 hours, you get up and you go, and you say goodbye, and it's a reading club.
I like that idea. I would augment it afterwards by
drinking.
If you're going to have an hour of reading or 2 hours of reading, then you have an hour or two of mingling afterwards so that everyone tells other people about the book that they're reading.
Right.
So it isn't a book club like you said.
Right.
But you get to know the people in the club by virtue of how they talk about the book.
And by virtue of the fact that everybody loves reading, they are doing that. But he's not setting that up as a rule of the reading club. The rule of the reading club is just come there and
read. I think in LA you would need to set up that part of it. Don't you think? Because it's harder to get around and it's so geographically spread out. There isn't... I mean, we went to that library. I mean, if it's at the Rem Cool House...
No, it's not. It's in a...
Everyone would want to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But here it's hard to find that kind of environment. So that would be... Something. That would be fun. I like that idea.
That
a lot.
Is.
Another resolution that I had.
Oh.
Which needed to be specifically done by the end of this month.
Holy.
By the end of January, was I needed to see all the films on the Metacritic consensus list of the top films of 2011.
Right.
And this is the clearinghouse Metacritic that assembles every single top 10 list by each critic and assigns points to it and then gives the consensus.
Yeah.
And there were 32. Now, they've been updating it regularly.
Of course.
So those films have been slightly changing, shifting in position, but I set my resolution on a certain date, so it was that list as of that day.
Right.
There were 32 films on the consensus. I had seen 16 of them at that point.
Right.
So that meant 16
still out
I needed
there.
In 4 weeks before our top 10 show.
You were taking that seriously. Yeah.
I bring this up because I saw four of them.
Yeah.
So I'm on average, if I do four each week, I will have achieved it. However, I fear I will not be able to do this.
Wow.
And it will be entirely out of my control.
Because?
I bring forth the strange tale of the film Margaret. Have you heard of it?
No.
No. And it's odd that you have not heard of it.
It is odd.
Because it is written and directed. The second film from Oscar-nominated writer and Oscar-nominated director Kenneth Lonergan, who was nominated for both for You Can Count on Me in 2000. Here we are 11 years later, and a man who got Oscar-nominated for his only film is finally has his second film released, and you haven't heard of it.
And you can't even...
And I hadn't heard of it. Oh, can't even find it, dear God. But you haven't even heard of it, and the stars are Anna Paquin...
Wow.
Matt Damon,
uh-huh.
Matthew Broderick, Mark Ruffalo, Allison Janney, Jean Reno, Rosemary DeWitt, and Kieran Culkin.
Now, so, I had seen that cast lined up, but I didn't know what the movie was.
It came out September 30th.
Uh-huh.
It made $48,000 domestic. $48,000.
So he just found the change in the seats of the one theater that played it.
And the reason that... again, this came to my attention, is it's 11th on the Metacritic list of the top 10 films overall, which is amazing when you consider how many critics never got to see it, because it does have a huge amount of number one votes as
really?
The best film overall. So this is why, and so I read about what it is. After witnessing a fatal bus crash, New York City high school student Margaret believes she was an accidental factor in the tragedy. I won't give away any more of the
okay.
story. Apparently, it's one of the best performances ever by a 17 or an 18-year-old.
Wow.
And that 17 or 18-year-old is Anna Paquin. Well, this makes me scratch my head, because she's not 17 or 18.
No.
She was when they shot the movie.
What?
This is how long this has been sitting on the show.
Oh, my gosh. So has he been stuck in post-production? What's happened?
I finally got some answers last night. He finished in 2007, after a couple of years in post-production, and battles over the cut.
Battles with
several lawsuits were filed by and between the studio, producers, the filmmaker, naming each other, just a horrible thing. Matthew Broderick apparently loaned the money to Kenneth Lonergan to file a countersuit once he got sued, because the cast has been going to bat for him, apparently. Sidney Pollack took over the film and edited it.
Wow.
That did not get released. I forget who else.
He passed away, of course. He's dead? No.
Finally, apparently Kenneth Lonergan had a 3-hour cut he wanted released.
Okay.
Fox Searchlight said there is no way we will release a film over 2 hours.
They can't do it.
You know, these things are just so arbitrary.
Right.
As opposed to, hey, we all wanted to make this film. We all love this film. We all love what we shot. Now let's continue to ride the horse in the direction it's going. God forbid.
No.
Finally... Martin Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker stepped in as arbitrators, as mediators.
In the lawsuit. They weren't even... Not in the post-production.
To edit the film.
They're in the
editor.
They
took over the film.
Well, you couldn't
have
it
done. As mediators, as arbitrators, given Final Cut, themselves, and delivered a 2.5-hour cut that gained the approval of both the studio and the filmmaker, and that is what was released on September 30th.
Right. With probably
two pretty good reviews. Overwhelmingly great reviews, but pretty good reviews. Probably 70% positive on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
But those 70% loved it.
Right.
Okay. And legend of this film grew to the point that critics formed something called Team Margaret.
Yeah.
Because what they were shocked by was not only did they never expand the film or open it in other areas, they did not set up screenings for any critics group. They did not send screeners to any critics group, to any guild or union award group.
Wow.
Fox Searchlight did not want this, or someone did not want this getting award consideration. And yet it still ended up making these top 10 lists. It's won a couple of awards. Anna Paquin has gotten honorable mention. In fact, National Society of Film Critics gave runner-up to Best Supporting Actress for a young woman who is in the film. So one of the things, Team Margaret, if you go to Twitter and do a hashtag Team Margaret, you'll find all this stuff about it. They got a release in London achieved to one theater, where since its release, it has been setting box office records.
Really? Well, I would think now.
And finally, the latest I heard is there's actually a screening today at USC that's been sold out for quite a while. The reservation list has been booked up. They are going to send the Academy screeners of it, apparently, this week, which is as close to too late as
for
possible.
A nomination.
And there's no plan for a DVD release. I heard something rumored about 2016.
So is this a case?
This is The Shadow of the Wind. This is the book that I just described to you. I am the young boy.
It was found
and
the film.
And Margaret is the Shadow of the Wind.
Now, is this a case of we blew so much money in legal that we either, A, don't think we can ever recoup those losses, or are we just walking away from a bad feeling or bad blood and just let this thing rot on the shelf?
Well, I don't know. And then you've got contracts of actors involved that make this messy as well.
Right.
I know for a fact from other friends, independent films, for example, that name actors often have interesting writers in their contract. For example, the film has to be a theatrical release first. It can't be a DVD release.
It can't go in reverse.
But there also might be actors who had cut approval. Or I don't know. I have no idea. That's what's so strange about this, because nobody's really, and again, probably because legal cases are still pending, no one's got the whole truth on this thing.
You know, and this is always the sad thing. I always get the odd email going, why are movies so lousy? Why is TV so bad? Why don't you do something? Why don't you save it? Why don't you get up there? And the question, it's not that it's bad, it's that there's so many tripwires on your path from making the thing to having it seen by everybody. I think about Jeff Garland, who plays Larry David's manager in Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I had lunch with him one day, and I said, what's the funniest thing you ever did? And he said, I wrote the funniest thing for CBS. It was a half-hour sitcom, the pilot. It tested through the roof. Executives loved it. And when it came to the day, they said, yeah, this is pretty similar to another pilot that we already have, so we're not going to show this. Because our deal with this other guy is, it pays more. So we're going to do that one instead. And he goes, well, okay, well, give me that and I'll go sell it to another network. And I go, no, we're not giving another network a hit. That'd be stupid. It's going to stay right here on the shelf.
Right.
And it stayed there on the shelf. And
buying it not to release it.
Buy it not to release it. Specifically so that...
Always our concern with Illumination, with the project.
Illumination, yeah. Exactly.
Which we need to have an off-air production meeting about.
One of our rare off-air
afterwards
productions.
Because... Light bulb moment over the holidays.
Really?
Yes.
Love those.
Courtesy of Ulrika, actually, who sent me a link, thank you, Ulrika, to a panel from almost a year ago of when Margin Call.
Margin
Call. One of my favorite films of the year.
You love that Margin Call.
Where Margin Call premiered at the Berlin Film Festival.
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess it premiered at Sundance earlier, but the whole cast and the director were at...
Margin Call, yeah,
at the Margin Call panel discussion, and light bulb moments during that panel discussion. So
fantastic.
We'll talk about this afterwards.
I love it. We're not stopping for commercial this
year. Not this week.
No.
Why? Come
on. We've got so much.
We're all sweaty and worked up, and plus we've had all the joy of these new segments.
And we talked about our own documentary already, so we don't know.
Well, now, much of our year has been spent with this documentary, right?
Yes.
And I love it because, you know, here we are talking about top 10 lists, and geez, there have been a couple years because we've done our top 10 list, and we'll do it on January 30th, Monday, January 30th, our top 10, which falls nicely in between when all the critics have had their say, and right before the big
award season,
the
shows.
Big guild, the unions, the guilds, the Oscars, all this, and we fall right in the middle.
Yeah, fantastic.
So we
slip
through the cracks.
Exactly.
Right in the middle. But there have been years, as you know, where, God, if it weren't for example, documentaries,
right,
we may have had top. We may not top 10 list. We would have had
top 7.
3 is missing. Number 2 is missing. Number 7 is missing. You know, cobbling together where documentaries really this year, which has been such a strong year, such a deep year for good movies, as evidenced by the fact that Metacritic's consensus list had 32 films on it.
Well, that's a
last
big deal.
Last year, I looked back to see how many I did just without it being my resolution. And I had seen 19 films on the Metacritic consensus list, but there were only 20 films.
Ah.
Because there was a smaller pool of films getting this big consensus.
I agree.
There have been more good films this year.
Right.
I actually went through the list of movies I saw this year and realized there were 60 thus far that I could recommend to people.
Wow.
More than a film a week
I could recommend
to people.
Yeah.
But not the case with documentaries.
Hmm.
And there are very few. There's only one that made the Metacritic consensus list. I'm not going to reveal what that was because I haven't seen it yet.
Can't even think of what it means.
Not Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Oh, I'm hurt.
Not that. But our friend Josh Glasgow,
yes,
partly due to my prompting, did his own top 10 list at Glasgow to the Movies.
Ah.
And I was thrilled to see several, I think 4 documentaries made his list because he loves documentaries.
Including?
Including one that I saw this week, Tabloid. And I had wanted to see this summer from documentarian Errol Morris. And he is...
A big deal.
He's on the Mount Rushmore.
Totally.
Of documentaries.
You think Dr. Death? You think, what was the court case? Thin Blue Line?
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking Gates of Heaven.
Gates of Heaven.
Pet Cemetery.
Yeah, the Pet Cemetery.
Brief History of Time. Someone who is able to make those concepts, Stephen Hawking's concepts, and weave them with his life story and make it this thrilling, fun, funny 90-minute ride.
Yeah, amazing.
Really a groundbreaking documentarian.
Yeah.
And I didn't see Tabloid, and I wondered why I didn't see Tabloid and what it was about the mediocre kind of reviews about it. And... yeah, it's not the same Errol Morris. He's not breaking ground anymore. And in fact, what's really interesting was in a post-truth is out there world, his which posits the possibility that elevating consciousness is to hold all possibilities and build out of all those possibilities the world in which you wish to live.
Uh-huh.
His approach to Tabloid is really quite disappointing.
Oh, really?
And sort of small-minded.
Really?
Sort of a, it's this or that kind of approach, or the truth is somewhere in between.
Hmm.
It was really sort of disappointing. It was disappointing in a stylistic level, but it was also really disappointing from a filmmaker who traditionally had made us think about the truth in such unique different ways, approaching things from different perspectives, and for him to make a film that is
lame,
kind of poking fun at its subject, was disheartening.
Oh, that is kind of sad.
Yeah.
Ah, well, you took the wind out of my sails
on that one. Yeah. But I am looking forward to seeing several of these others that were on Josh's list, including one that has indeed, like I said, made the
Wow.
Consensus list.
I'm going to have to see something.
I did. The other thing that I love about using this Metacritic, because again, this New Year's resolution thing, instead of it being a to-do list, it's about setting intention.
Right.
And as many great films as I've seen this year, I did feel that I didn't get to see as many wonderful foreign language films as I usually do. And
you
again,
think?
There have been years where if it weren't for foreign language films, I wouldn't have a top 10 list.
There wouldn't be anything on there.
My number one film, quite often, would be a foreign language film.
I recall.
And this year, I didn't get to see the number of them. It was almost hard for them to find their way in the marketplace.
Because so many big things are up?
And so many great small things are vying for the
right.
screens. So, again, there's many foreign language films on this Metacritic consensus that some I had forgotten about, some I hadn't heard of at all. And so that's what's fun about it is, oh, good, I get to fill that need that felt unfulfilled all last year.
Right.
I saw one from Thailand.
Oh.
A ghost story.
Really?
Called Uncle Boon Me, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. And it's set during the final days of this man who runs an orchard and who has no close relatives anymore because his wife died of cancer decades earlier, and she revisits him during his final days, and a son who went missing many years earlier who revisits during his final days. Turns out he's still alive in a slightly different form, and and he begins to have recall of all his past lives.
Wow.
It didn't work for me.
Oh.
But
I love the concept.
But isn't it a fun? And see, this is the thing. These are interesting stories that I wouldn't have known about were it not for
Metacritic
consensus.
I see.
So
I'm gonna okay.
I did feel a couple times though in the last couple weeks that Dean Haglin has become a shadowy reflection upon me. in part by seeing Attack the Block.
Ow! Did you love it?
Did you see it?
You know what? I didn't. I have not actually seen it.
See, this is what's so odd about it.
I love it.
I'm seeing this film knowing
this is everything that I want.
You are the demographic.
I am the demographic.
And I'm watching it and you didn't.
I was scheduled to see it a Tuesday night and something came up. I was going to go the Friday it opened and something came up. And then I was going to download it, and my account expired. You know, there's like a thousand excuses of why this is the movie I've tried to see more than any other movie.
UK indie film,
so spectacular,
about a street gang of teens who terrorize the block in which they live.
And then
who take it personally when there is an alien invasion.
An alien invasion. Yeah.
Anything to tell anything more would be to give too much away.
Too much away. But the trailer, hilarious.
I had fun with it. And at the same time, I spent the whole time feeling I was just watching it for you.
Did you laugh at the right parts? Did you?
I laughed at parts.
Yeah.
And I was moved at parts. And I went... Well, that was what it was.
Which is how I see most of my movies. Hey, that was what it was.
Another film that I watched and enjoyed, talking about second films by acclaimed filmmakers, do you remember the wonderful indie hit, I guess we can call it,
okay,
because it got good notoriety from maybe 7 years ago or more now?
You're
maybe
talking even 2001?
No, 2000, 7 years ago.
No, sorry, 2003?
That was 10 years ago, by the way. Me, You, and Everyone We Know by Miranda July, the film that kind of put John Hawkes really on the map as an indie film actor.
Right.
She finally followed up that film with a film called The Future this summer.
I see.
And quite a delightful film. This is a film that is bubbling around number 32 on the Metacritic list. And yet what's interesting is it has the seventh most first place votes of any film. And it's in the top 10 if you only counted first and second place votes.
Wow.
But
so it's polarizing.
I don't know if she is an acquired taste so much, but she's somewhat of a peculiar, specific taste. I don't know if you could acquire it. I think you have to have a certain fondness for certain things. But I am watching this and I'm suddenly realizing, I'm asking myself a question over and over again while watching this film. Why isn't Dean Haglund the biggest Miranda July fan on the planet? Because this is a woman who, much like our beloved Marx Brothers, works out all her stories through performance pieces for years before she has them down. Her performance pieces combine storytelling, combine improv comedy, combine painting.
What?
Combine dance.
Come on.
And she's doing all these things.
What?
So she's showing her new paintings. She's talking about them. She's doing dance things, performance pieces, improv comedy, telling stories. This is how, and she weaves these things together. One example of something that's wonderful in it, there is a man in it who's so specific and so good, and you're asking yourself, how can they, where did they find this actor? How is he so specific and so real and so good at this? And it's a man that one of the main characters finds in the Penny Saver ad advertising selling a refurbished handheld hairdryer for $3. And he gives a monologue about the hairdryer. And you're going, who is this guy? It's a guy that Miranda July found in the Penny Saver advertising a refurbished hairdryer for $3.
Wow.
Yeah, and none of his stuff is scripted, and she just kind of
filmed him
and improvised.
Talking with his thing. So anyway, it's called The Future.
Yeah.
Where is it playing? Where did you see it?
I saw it on DVD. It played during the summer theatrically, and I finally caught up with it on DVD.
I am shocked that this has skipped my radar somehow. I am now, this is my goal, just to see that movie. One more New Year's resolution that I can tag on to last year's
show. This is what I'm thinking I might end up using my top 10 list for in some way this year, is that because there have been so many, and how do I judge what do I love more or what do I appreciate more? And I'm thinking it'd be twofold. Any films that have a chance of someday making my best of the decade list need to be on there.
Right.
Which will be the show where I think we introduce our permanent theme song.
That'd be good.
And which ones do I feel were underappreciated or overlooked in some way?
Right.
So over that I can champion years. Those. Which ones are the ones that need, which of my children need the love the most?
I would think Team Margaret sounds like a big...
And one of those films, speaking of children that need the love the most, is We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Oh.
Tilda Swinton nominated for a SAG Award for Best Actress, probably, hopefully, for Oscar. And I can't believe I just said I hope Tilda Swinton's nominated for something.
I know.
There is scenes at the beginning where Tilda Swinton is carrying a baby who will not stop screaming. She, to take a break from the screaming, she goes and parks the carriage and stands next to a construction worker who's using a jackhammer. Just so that she can drown out the screaming for a few minutes, the piece of a jackhammer. And I, of course, am thinking, oh, that poor little baby was just shown Tilda Swinton in I Am Love. I'm not a Tilda Swinton fan.
You are not. I've heard that many a time.
To me, Tilda Swinton is this generation's Glenn Close. That's the comparison I would like to make. And of course, a woman of talent and a woman of really interesting taste when it comes to choosing roles and doing this. None of this. There is just something. John Saxon once asked me whether I liked John Malkovich's work. Uh-huh. This is going back 17 years now. No, 14 years.
14 years ago. Okay,
here's he asked me because I think
let me picture this in my head. John
Saxon. I think he was on an Academy panel of foreign language films with John Malkovich, and he asked me whether I liked John Malkovich's work, and I said, yeah, I really, really do. And he said, yeah, he's a very good actor, and there's just something about him that makes me want to punch him in the face. On screen, how he
on
comes
screen.
Off.
Yeah, right?
And I can understand. There's just certain performers that get under our skin in some way. And Tilda Swinton is this way for me.
Right. And as they say, it's often the mirror that reflects that irritates you the most.
Maybe.
Right?
Maybe. Absolutely.
I'm just saying.
So, and then you combine that with the fact that We Need to Talk About Kevin is an excruciating movie to watch.
It sounded too excruciating for a night out of...
It may be too excruciating to watch. It's not one of those films that I would ever recommend. However, I saw it at the Directors Guild, where it received almost universal hatred. And afterwards, hearing people talk about how awful it was, how horrible. And I finally started just engaging with all these people and say, what was wrong with it?
Right.
What were they doing? And all that came across was how unpleasant it was.
Right.
And
it's well done, but it's unpleasant.
And it was, in fact, I would argue it's perfectly done.
Right.
You know, and these people who want to write off, well, it's just a movie about a kid who's born a monster. And I'm saying, boy, you got nothing out of this. Because this is a film, and this is why I would champion it, that really gets how we are all complicit in creating monsters that perpetrate great acts of violence. Right. Societally, we are. But also, it shows the upbringing of this child, and it shows time and time again so many opportunities to take a different step that could have led to a different result.
Right.
It basically hits every single warning sign in the playbook of how we know this kind of behavior comes about. And what disturbs me about the reaction is not, I would not be disturbed if people didn't go to see it. But the people who are seeing it, and especially these are people who tell stories for a living, their reaction to it that somehow this shouldn't be told is really scary.
That is scary, right.
Because these events actually do happen.
Right.
And ought we not to have at least a few stories that tries not only to make sense of them, but tries to tell us how we can form a different relationship to things so that they don't happen.
Right. So that we can change within ourselves that which makes that horrible.
Well, indeed, maybe these things do happen because we have no relationship to these things, and that absolute lack of a relationship is reflected in the reaction to someone trying to deal with these
Interesting.
Issues. So, so that is how I might use my top 10 list.
Well, that would be fantastic
year.
If you did that. I'm going to use it as the movies I actually saw.
If it's you saw really, 10, I if mean...
I'm not even sure I saw 10. Maybe I should have like the lamest things I saw this year.
Well, no. That would be your top 10 list. you know what I saw? Also what I saw, which is not making any top 10 lists, and I'm quite surprised. I don't understand why it's not.
You really enjoyed this?
Is John Michael McDonough's directorial and debut, The Guard, an Irish comedy caper film starring Brendan Gleeson as an Irish cop and Don Cheadle as an FBI agent.
Oh, yeah.
Investigating a smuggling ring.
The trailer looked cute-ish.
John Michael McDonough is the brother of Martin McDonough, the filmmaker who made the less pleasing In Bruges, which was very precious.
Right.
And this film really kind of, I felt like, was the movie In Bruges wanted to be. But, of course, Martin McDonagh is a brilliant playwright and acclaimed playwright. So anyway, so this was fantastic, and I don't understand why this is not making top 10 lists.
Well, I don't know anybody else other than you who's seen it. I haven't even spoken.
And it's fascinating. It made something like $13 million worldwide. Worldwide. This is a film with lots of comedy, lots of action, lots of thrills. It's kind of sexy. It's funny.
Don Cheadle.
It's irreverent. It's got names, and it could only make $13 million because somehow people decided that this is an art film. I mean, I don't understand where...
I thought it was the Irish version of Mall Cop. I didn't know. Maybe the marketing.
Oh, maybe the marketing was terrible.
Maybe the marketing was
terrible.
But
it's really funny. It's really funny. I mean, I was backing up while watching it to watch parts again. They were so funny.
Wow. So you have it on DVD?
I did until I sent it back. I've been doing my work, man. I've been.
I've been doing work too, pal.
Oh, well, this is my resolution.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good one. Yeah.
I'm seeing, because that Metacritic list was only part of it, I have 35, I had set 35 films that I wanted to see this month, actually.
Yeah, that's a big list.
Another film that I watched that I want to see if you've watched, and I thought we would maybe get into talking about this, but...
I don't know if we have time.
Maybe we'll set the agenda for next week.
Fantastic.
But I spent the first 80 minutes of Mission Impossible 4 wondering why that didn't make a single top 10 list.
Really?
Because I thought, well, this is really, really good. Then I spent the next hour understanding why it didn't make a top 10 list. No, and not that it was bad, but it doesn't maintain...
It cannot maintain that.
It is very much the best of the films.
Yeah.
Now, have you seen this yet?
I'm going this week. That's how
this was a month and a half ago. You had the opening day.
I know.
Like, circled on your calendar.
It's true. And it's Brad Bird. Like, my favorite... This animator, this is his first live-action film. He's the guy who did The Incredibles. He goes back... through Pixar. He was in the best days of The Simpsons he worked on. He was one of the original animators at Disney. This guy has Hollywood pedigree all over him.
And that usually doesn't matter. That usually doesn't matter, especially in an action film. Like, if he was directing a James Bond, none of that would matter.
True.
Right? It would come down to whether the script was good and you know, whether they could, the action was well done. But Mission Impossible is a really unique franchise in that, say what you will about the quality of any of the individual entries, it allows each director to really
shine.
Make it
an individual voice of that director.
Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible looks like a Brian De Palma. You can tell it's Brian De Palma. John Woo's looks like John Woo. J.J. Abrams. So each one
really brings
it. Tom Cruise, hats off to him. He has the directors. He encourages them, builds a team around them that lets the directors give their own personal expression, and their handprints are all over.
It's true. It's true. So that's on my list. We'll talk about that next week.
And of course, we both saw Sherlock Holmes Game of Shadows.
Yes.
Which I don't think we'll necessarily need to talk about next week, because I don't think anyone will remember that it ever came out by next week. Boy, I mean, the way that Mission Impossible, would have thought how that...
Has a wave.
Surpassed it, because it really, we both thought that Sherlock Holmes was being set up to be
the long
not
run.
Only the big film of the holidays, but boy, a huge blockbuster.
Yeah.
And it's going to end up making so much less than the first one. And boy, if I had seen Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock on TV prior to seeing Sherlock Holmes 2, which I hadn't even, I would not have even walked out of Sherlock Holmes 2, because Robert Downey Jr. is now the second most interesting actor, second best actor, playing
Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes. And Benedict Cumberbatch, my new man crush. did you see villain in the new Star Trek film?
Oh, yeah, that's him.
He's replacing Benicio del Toro, who dropped out.
Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's going to be awesome.
He is everywhere right now, Benedict Cumberbatch.
And why not? Because
he's really good.
Kicking ass
on
that
really
thing.
He's really good.
Totally. Anyway, that brings us to an end of another fantastic Chillpack Hollywood Hour. It's, as always, a joy. And, of course, you can write us.
Well, you can write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
Yes.
You can find every installment of your Chillpack Hollywood. Eventually, you'll be able to. You can find many of them.
Many of them.
Chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com.
Like us on Facebook.
You can download and stream the episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or really simple syndication.
Right.
Please like us on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. If you write us on either our email address or on Facebook, we'll read your message, answer your questions on the show. That's
so
why
much fun.
It is your Chillpack Hollywood Hour.
So easy.
Dean Haglund can be followed on Twitter.
I'm at D Haglund.
I can be followed on Twitter at Phil Lambs.
So easy. We'll see you next week.
Belated spoiler alert.